Hello, and you're listening to WGLZ Radio, College Radio, where we are Apache Vocal. Hello, folks. I'm Taylor Marty, and today I'm going to be interviewing a man very well known on campus, a great English professor, so I've heard, my name is Dr. Peter Stifel. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course, of course. So you've been here for a very long time, I've heard.
Yeah, I've been about 25 years at this university.
Wow, yeah. 25 years.
Yeah, yeah, I'm one of the longest serving people here now. When I came, it was there was a very senior faculty, and I was thought of as young, which I wasn't anymore. But to them, I was. And now it's kind of been flipped. Virtually everybody's gone from the time when I first came.
Yeah. So let's start it off with this, since you've been, you know, we'll start from the beginning of your life in a nutshell. Tell me, where are you from?
Okay. I was born in the Washington, D.C. area, and my father worked for Southern Railway, so we moved throughout the Southeast, and I lived in Atlanta, and I lived in Chattanooga, and then we came back to D.C., so my high schooling, junior high and high schooling, was in the D.C. area, in Fairfax, Virginia, and then I went to university at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I loved being there, and then I was in the military. I was in the Navy for 2.5 years. And got out, and then knew I wanted to go to grad school at that point, and went to the University of Idaho. My brother and I, my parents had both died by that time, and so my brother had resettled in northern Idaho because he was interested in forestry.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a wonderful school. So I did my master's in English there, which was a really good experience for me because, they treated you like real faculty. It was great for grad school.
That's good.
Then I went, weren't a lot of jobs in academia at that time, so I decided I'd delay my PhD for a while, and I went and lived in Europe for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Germany for a year, and then in Scotland, where I have a degree from Edinburgh University in Scotland in classics.
Wow.
Because by that time I knew I wanted to do sort of neoclassical literature. And so I thought I'd had some Latin, so I did Latin and Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And there, from there, I married over there, and she had finished her PhD, and so I came back to the States to do my PhD, and we went to Tulane in New Orleans because they gave me a full ride scholarship, and we thought New Orleans would be a really enjoyable place to live, and it was. It's a fantastic mm-hmm. place, all pre-Katrina, of course.
Yeah.
Although now, in many ways, the university itself has thrived from that. They really made the most of sort of helping the comeback in New Orleans.
That's good.
And then I finished my PhD there, and then I've been teaching up here ever since.
So what made you come up to West Liberty, if I may ask?
Job. I mean, it'd be nice if you could say, well, I think I'm going to go teach in California, probably at UCLA, but it doesn't work that way. they have big conferences in which, it's a sort of year-long cycle, and they advertise for jobs.
Uh-huh.
And now's usually the time that people start thinking about what they're going to need for next year. Job adverts go out in the autumn. Then there's the big. You often do. You make certain cuts, you know, by your credential, and then they'll do sometimes telephone interviews, and then they'll do in-person interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you're going to get a job, it'll probably be in the springtime, and that gives you then that summer to move and get there. So, came up here because there was a job up here.
Well, what I would like to ask, though, what, other than the water, because New Orleans is, you know, there's a lot of wet land down there, and there's not really much up here, just depends on where you go in the state. What's the big difference?
Well, one of the things we noticed right away was terrain. New Orleans flat.
Oh,
completely
yeah.
flat. And I grew up in terrain like this, and so this really spoke to me. I really enjoyed driving around here. Four seasons meant a lot. The color. New Orleans is an incredibly colorful place, but it's also incredibly hot. It's mm-hmm. we always laughed as two seasons, hot and hotter, or hot and unbearable. When all the sort of about mid-March to April, it can start getting really hot, and it stays that way till end of October usually.
Oh, my goodness. So
you just get used to, you know, being really sweaty,
mm-hmm.
and then you go into freezing cold because they over-air conditioned. So it was people got colds in the summer there, and in the winter it was fine. You know, it was great. that was a big difference. Food was a real big difference because New Orleans is a food center.
Mm-hmm.
And we really loved that. I didn't have to have a lot of money to still eat really well there. And as a grad student, of course, you don't have much money.
Mm-hmm.
We got up here, though, and we discovered a lot of different kinds of food. And we've really, it took us a while to call this home.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we realized that we were saying home. We said, I guess, yeah, it is. And places like Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh is a wonderful place and has a lot to offer of all kinds of ethnicity and therefore interesting food and interesting music and interesting theater even. And so, fantastic kind of architecture and a city that's built. It's a lot like Edinburgh where I went to university in Scotland, where the geography is really irregular. But the city's built into the geography, and Pittsburgh's like that, which is one of the things I really enjoy about the city.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's not a grid.
Pittsburgh is a very pretty place. At night, I'll give my little synopsis, but I went up there for a concert of some sort. It was for One Direction, and just seeing the pretty blue, the colors of the buildings and just driving by them, and it's just beautiful. I love Pittsburgh.
And it's the greatest entry. If you went up through the tunnel and came down the rivers, it's the greatest entrance to any city in the world. It really is. Every time you go through that, if you pay attention because it takes your breath away. It's really great.
If you have the perfect song too with it and you got the windows down, that's when it's really good. I've done that once with a friend and we're like, that was satisfying. We need to do it again.
Well, what's that that book that was made a film about Wallflower? That's set in Pittsburgh, and one of the scenes in that, the kids stand up in the back of a pickup truck and sing really loudly as they go through the tunnel and then burst out into that. So I thought that was great.
Yeah. Wow. Let's get trying to back to more of like your studies in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to become an English professor?
I a real clear moment. I'm of what's called the kind of Sputnik generation. That is, the Russians launched Sputnik, and everybody that was young was instantly put into math and science, like STEM is such a big deal now.
Yeah.
And so I went through all those, and I was really good at them. I'm a pretty smart guy. But I got to college, and, man, it's like I hit the wall with math. I just, whoa. And also, I didn't really like the math and science. Mm-hmm. And I took an English course, which was just an elective course. And it was not even in the English building. It was this old World War II kind of Quonset hut place.
Wow.
And there's about 30 of us in the class and a few English majors, but mostly it was just other people taking, you had to take one upper division English course. And this guy walks in, and there was a piano in the room, upright. This guy walks in, a young guy, his professor, and he says, "Oh, my God, a piano!" And he rushes over to him, starts playing it and singing. And then he says, "Oh, I got to stop now, but we'll get back to this." And he was a young professor who was teaching 18th century British literature. And because of him and his teaching and the subject matter itself, I said, that's what I want to do, and I want that field, and it's what my specialty is. It's the first really. If you were traveling a time machine and they dropped you in the 18th century, you'd say, "I can get along here." Everything that we do now kind of started in there.
Yeah.
That class really did it. That was wonderful. Yeah.
Do you remember that professor's name by chance?
I was afraid you were going to ask that. I can see him, and I had friends who went to grad school when he was no longer a junior professor, and talked about him. He founded a punk band there, and I'll come up with it in a minute. I can't think of it right now.
All good.
Yeah, he's retired. Like I'll be in a couple months.
Yeah, I've heard about that. But anyways, we're going to go on break. We'll be back. Right back with you guys in about a minute. And we're back. I'm here with Dr. Peter Stifel, and you have been a professor here for about 25 years?
Yeah.
And you went to a lot of schools.
Yeah, yeah.
I try to write them all down. Basically, you went to University Chapel in North Carolina, am I correct?
Chapel Hill, right.
Yeah, Chapel Hill. And then you've also traveled to Europe. You went to Scotland to get your...
Well, I got another master's there, and I have a master's from the University of Idaho first, and then the Scottish degree, and then came back to Tulane for my PhD.
Gotcha. How was it in Europe, I must ask?
Oh, I'd always wanted to be there. My, both my parents had European parents.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always been, that had always been the place I wanted to go. When I was in the military, I was in Asia. I went to, you know, the Philippines and Japan and into China and really enjoyed that. But it was not a place I'd ever thought I'd go. And if I hadn't been in the military, I probably wouldn't have.
Yeah.
But I'd always wanted to go to Europe just because of things I studied and because, you know, sort of my heritage. And you know, growing up, we'd go when I'd go to Iowa to visit my mother's family. They were farmers out there. Occasionally, some member of the extended family from Europe, Denmark or Germany or someplace, would be there. And so that was always, for a kid, that was a real object of fascination to me. Boy, you've come a long way. Well in fact, when I was a little kid and going out there, there wasn't a lot of travel in America. And so, like, many of my relatives had never been outside the county that they were in there. So when we would go out there in the summer, that's halfway across America, the kids we'd meet, at the swimming pool and learn to play with, some were our relatives and others were their friends. To us, they were exotic creatures. They lived on farms and they got to milk cows and gather the eggs. And that was just, to us, that was so cool. And we were real cool to them because we had seen the ocean. We'd been swimming in, they'd seen, of course, films and television.
Yeah.
But, mountains, what's mountains? They knew what they were. Again, that things have changed so radically in terms of, in many ways, as one knows. But when I think back upon things like that, those are the things that make me go, gee whiz, that is really different, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Wow, that's really.
But no, Europe is. When I was in school, now everybody studies Spanish, but then everybody studied French. It was a holdover from the sort of English education, and so I wanted, and I like language, and I love. I can still read French, and I've a good accent, but I've lost much of my vocabulary. So I enjoyed traveling there, and if you ever have a language and travel, what you'll see is when you're on your own, and have to use it. It's great because then you just go ahead and know you're making mistakes and it doesn't matter, but you don't care. They'll just, they can get you.
Yeah.
And I lived in Germany and I hadn't studied German, but I'd wanted to because my grandfather was German.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I should somehow. My name, Stoffel, is it's in German, Stoffel.
Stoffel, gotcha.
Made me want to know more about that. And so I really enjoyed the, I was there just about a year and I got pretty proficient in the language. And still have a basic proficiency in it. And so seeing a lot of the artwork and the architecture, the countrysides looked, like things I was used to seeing, but the architecture was very different, and so much more access to art than I had growing up. Although I when I was in D.C., we had all the national galleries and they were free. That was different, so that was good there.
Yeah. So, speaking of differences, when you also went down to New Orleans to live with your wife, and then you came up here for the job, I wanted to know, what was the campus like when you came around?
The campus was pretty much the same. Now, there's the new building, the science building down there, which was built, and there was a lot more faculty housing on campus, and it was all faculty. Now, much of it's fraternity and student housing, and that's all new. Across the street, that's all new.
Yeah.
But what we did not have, and what I really miss, is we have the center out at the Highlands, where we always used to have summer school on campus. And so campus was quiet, but not dead in the summer. And it was really nice being, I lived in West Liberty and I live in Bethany now.
Okay.
And so I always taught summer school then, and really enjoyed it because summer school then was, most of my students were not from here. They were often local kids who were going to WVU or Marshall and needed to get, an English class that was required there, and they were going to take it here in the summer. And so you got to meet a lot of different students. There were still plenty of science, majors on campus, as there are now, because the Highlands Center doesn't have this, doesn't do that kind of work out there. But it was also, the atmosphere was different because that faculty that had been here so long, it was just in the process of starting to turn over when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
They had raised their families here. A lot of their kids went here. Like I taught one summer school here. Ryan McCulloch, who's of course who's married to my boss, and who teaches, is a wonderful teacher here. And it was such a treat. I remember his father, who was the provost at the time, came and asked me if it was okay if his son took on a class. I said, "You run this university. You're asking me." And he just wanted to know if I'd be embarrassed about having his son there. I said, no, that's great. And Ryan was wonderful. It was a class that was, as it turned out, were all boys. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that happened. But I was using this really, a new book at the time was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the most fun classes I ever had, partially because of the book and partially because these guys, many of whom knew each other, and they were just really relaxed. And we had a really good term with them. That was fun. So campus was different that way, too, because the people who worked on campus had also, like the faculty, many of them were faculty wives or spouses, had been here a long time, and everybody knew everybody well. If people often moved around jobs, and if someone left or was ill or something, there was always somebody who knew that job, and there was much more sense of sort of camaraderie and a real close community sense here. Many of the faculty had raised their kids here, and that just doesn't happen anymore because so many faculties of my generation and later are usually both members of the family are educated, and so you live away and come here.
Right.
So that's changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say it's better for worse. It's just has changed the environment.
Yeah, wow. That's quite the changes. I didn't know you taught by Ryan McCulloch.
Yeah, that was fun.
Professor Ryan McCulloch.
He's a good student, yeah.
Yeah. I had him, I think it was in the fall, for one of the hardest classes I've ever took. I had fun with it. Very hard, but I enjoyed it.
Well, composition, I mean, communication theory is tough stuff.
It really is.
A lot of people think just standing up and talking, but... He is in the process of being almost finished with his dissertation. So, in the process of teaching overloads every semester,
mm-hmm.
And teaching all kinds of different courses too at all levels, he's been doing graduate study and then studying and passing his exams, and now he's writing his dissertation. I know one way he manages is that both he and his wife have the same kind of job, so they understand each other that way in the time commitment, and they don't have any children, so that they can donate that time to their cats and their work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He always talked about his cats, too, in our class.
He's got great cats. Yeah,
I'm afraid. So we were also talking about, students when the summer school, and, you meet so many different people,
yeah.
And just not in summer school in general, just
yeah.
even today. What is the biggest changes you've seen in students? Let's say like socially or how things
oh.
have been.
Well, that's kind of easy, and that's the internet. So when I came, most students didn't have access to computers, and so we had
mm-hmm.
what's now our writing center was the computer lab, and there are all these desktops. And every comp class, you had to have one class a week in the lab, so scheduling it was busy. So students would have access to and learn how to do word processing. And when I think about that, I am a real bonehead when it comes to technology. Here I was often trying to teach them how to do it. So, blind leading the blind.
Mm-hmm.
But then we developed, then laptops came in, and we were the first school in the nation, I think, to have a laptop program. So when you came, you
wow.
were given a laptop. It was paid for in your fees. And then we stopped the program because students already had laptops
mm-hmm.
and they didn't need one. And so just that and all the technological things around it, like cell phones and
mm-hmm.
And social media, all that's radically changed. And one of the things that I find kind of sad about that is, for instance, walking across campus now that the weather's changing, they put the games and stuff out, and it used to be full of kids talking to each other and playing the games and reading and hanging out. And and now half the kids are walking, looking down at their telephone sort of missing out on each other. So as much as technology has changed the classroom, it's,
mm-hmm.
It's changed the atmosphere of what people do, too. So it's
mm-hmm.
that's been a radical change,
yeah.
probably the biggest difference.
Yeah, yeah, as of now, as we speak, they've got the games out and everything.
Yeah, I know. I saw them the other day. I almost went over and started playing some cornhole. I love throwing cornhole.
I love cornhole. Cornhole is fun at family reunions.
Oh, yeah, it's a great game. I didn't know about that until I came up here.
Really?
Wasn't anything I'd ever played. So that's been a real addition. And pickleball. I play pickleball.
Oh, pickleball's
that's
fun.
A great game.
That was back in high school. I say back in high school. I'm making myself sound old. It was very competitive in my high school. We played pickleball.
Whew. Oh, man.
Skinned knees. Oh, fun times. But speaking of kind of on technology and how it's changed, I've also heard that you were a part of the West Virginia Public Radio Advisory Board.
I've been... When my wife and I came back from Europe all those years ago, public radio was just getting started.
Right.
And I was used to having really good radio overseas because television, you didn't have much access to it. In Britain, you charge for television, so students didn't have much of it. And I just found watching commercial television really difficult because everything was broken up by commercials and things. So I didn't watch as much television as I had before, but there was radio. And this was something that I never had. I'd only had sort of pop music and radio growing up, as everybody did. And so that was a real change. And so my wife and I just, that became kind of one of the central features in any place we lived, that the radio came on when we got up and it went off when we went to sleep. And it was always just on public radio. And then when we got here, the public radio has what's called the Friends Board, which are listeners who want to participate in sort of helping run the system in a modest way. We get a certain amount of the money that comes in, and we use it on different projects to help in any way we can help the system. And you vote. So there's a number of districts all around the state, and you have different, you vote people on for 3-year terms, and you go down quarterly meetings and you go to those and you make policy decisions. And I was here at graduation 1 year, and it's happening right now. This is the time when you elect new reps. And so at graduation, Dean Javersack, David Javersack, went here and was dean, wonderful man, great historian, he congratulated me. And I said, well, what for, David? Did I win the lottery or something? And he said, no, well, you're on public, you're on the Friends Board. And I went, how did I get on that? I didn't. And my wife had nominated me.
Oh, gotcha.
And not told me, which I thought was... And then she sneaked the ballot up so she could fill out the ballot so I wouldn't see my name on it. And that was, my goodness, I think I've been reelected 5 times.
Wow.
I don't campaign. You don't really... I mean, it's
yeah, of course.
But it's been a wonderful experience for me. One of the things that we've been trying to do for years, it's a long trek down to Charleston, 4 times a year. I drive down with my wife usually, but other times with maybe one of the people up here, just on my own. And it's a long way and then a long way back. And then because of COVID, we finally got invested in Zoom and other technologies like that. And I think now there will still be quarterly meetings.
Yes.
But you will have the option of just being... virtual if you want. We'll drive down because we like doing that. And I'll see. I think I'm up for election again next year, so this, I may be in my swan song now. This might be my last shot. I don't know. I'll find out if people want me to keep doing it. But it's that's been a revelation, learning about this. And one funny little story is when I was in New Orleans, the first year we were there, we were invited out to Thanksgiving dinner by a friend who was just inviting all these kind of stray people who had no family or anything there. And I was sitting next to a guy, he was this enormous man sitting next to me, and he worked for public radio. And so we were talking to him about it, and we had told him that we didn't have a car, we didn't have a television, when we arrived, we had no furniture, but we immediately subscribed to public broadcasting. And so he used that on the air, telling that about why everybody should. If these poor college students could do this, everybody should. And so that was kind of fun. And it turned out he had worked in West Virginia, and he was here when this became an actual statewide system.
Gotcha.
So I kind of feel that there's a nice little connection between that sort of early days and me as being connected to it. As there are still a few very elderly members of the board, older even than me, who it's hard to believe, who knew him and knew and were there when the station began, which
wow.
is great. Yeah.
Wow, that's insane. Since radio has changed so much over time, and you've been a part of the board.
Yeah.
What do you think of it today?
I think with streaming, it gives us access to so many channels, just like television. I mean, so the same thing with cable. That gives us an opportunity to really pick and choose. For West Virginia, what it means, what's positive about it is that we get a significant number of our listeners coming from out of state.
Mm-hmm.
And many people who've lived here and learned, you know, sort of became members and interested in public radio because of here, and then moved away. And now they can stream it and still listen to it. And they always tell us that when they, you know, in one of the fun drives or whatever, come on to resubscribe. And they say, oh, I do it because I just missed it too much. And it they remind us, too, of how good we are. I mean, we're a poor state. And as a system, we were always being cut back.
Mm-hmm.
But we win awards all the time. An incredibly good system. We have like 14 towers because our state is like this.
Yeah.
And so, and where most states have like one big tower. And so, you know, our costs and our production is really a complicated business, especially for an organization that has to run on a shoestring. I mean, we're a poor state. Our citizens give very generously to keep us going because, you know, we're non-political.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're the only news service that serves the whole state. We cover the legislature when they're in session. We're the ones who have the official announcement about what schools are closing, you know. So, you know, we're a real, and in terms of educational benefits, we do an extraordinary amount for the school systems and things available for them to use.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in terms of public radio, things have gotten, much, much better. Just they're learning to do more stuff. So I really can't speak to other kinds of radio because, I'm too old. I'm not allowed to listen to pop music. You know? I don't really know how things are going on radio. Occasionally I'll go through the dials and it sounds like it always has, except there's so much more talk radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that I find disturbing because I find most of it, a lot of loud noise. A lot of ignorance spread, a lot of, really awful kinds of prejudice, and often done just for the sake of attention, not because there's an attempt to do good or transmit information, but an attempt to, arouse and anger. And that's what makes you popular. And I find that kind of sad.
Yeah.
But there's, that's just the way things are, and I can't do anything about that.
Sadly,
I don't listen to that. So,
I don't either. I'd get too fired up.
Yeah, you do. You find yourself talking to the radio, and shaking your fist at you.
Going down.
I got to stop this.
Yeah. Sometimes I forget because sometimes I do plug in a Bluetooth to listen to my own music.
Sure.
But sometimes I just pull it out. And I just let the radio go while I drive back home. It's nice, but then I have to change the station because the static noises.
Yeah, I know. That's it's one of the same problems. We finally learned, we're using our telephones and hooking them up. We're such, sort of Cro-Magnons trying to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that has made, the problems of transmission and reception a lot better, too, to get all the streaming.
Yeah, that's for
not foolproof, but it's better.
Yeah, it's a lot better.
Yeah.
So my final question to you is, you said it a little bit before, this will be your final months on campus as you are retiring as of this year. So what do you plan to do after since you retire?
See, one of the problems with COVID has been there's all this time on my, that I don't go to plays or go to see music things. And so I bought enough books to last me to live to 150. So I got to get busy reading them and then giving them to the college, library, which everybody should do when they finish their books to help them build up their collection. So I'm looking forward to doing that and spending my wife and I will travel some now that we can. We bought tickets to take a summer in Britain.
Ooh.
3 years ago, and still haven't gotten there. I mean, we've gone plenty of times
because
she's still got family there. But we might go in the autumn, but probably wait till next spring when we're sure that we can. and see what happens. So.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Peter Stifel, for coming on, and thank you, folks, for listening. Again, this is WGLZ Radio, College Radio, where we are passionately vocal. I'm Taylor, and I'm signing off. Hope you have a good week.